from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
The 140th Fancy Farm Picnic is set for Saturday on the grounds of St. Jerome Catholic Church in Graves County, Kentucky. But this year's event will be considerably different because of COVID-19. There will still be plenty of world-famous West Kentucky barbecue for sale, but no political speeches. That's a time-honored tradition that has become the unofficial kickoff of Kentucky's fall campaign season. I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we'll talk about the history of the Fancy Farm Picnic and how it became a political event in addition to a parish fundraiser. And we'll discuss how the coronavirus pandemic and racial justice demonstrations are shaping this year's election campaigns. Plus, we'll check in with our reporters for the latest on the demonstrations and the battle against the spread of COVID-19. It's all coming up this hour on In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up on the program, we will mark the 140th anniversary of the Fancy Farm Picnic, which will be held tomorrow in Graves County, Kentucky. Coronavirus has forced organizers to scale back this year's event and cancel the political speeches. We'll talk a little later with Cynthia Elder, who has written a book about Fancy Farm, the place and the picnic, and Andy Hayden, one of the Fancy Farm picnic organizers. And longtime political writer Al Cross will join us later in the program to talk about the political speeches and this fall's political campaigns. But first, we're going to bring you an update on the two major stories we've been covering over the past several months, the ongoing racial justice demonstrations and the coronavirus, of course. And joining us are Jake Ryan from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting and Ryan Van Velzer, WFPL Energy and Environment reporter. They have covered both stories extensively, but let's start with you, Jake, and talk about the protest that started about 2 months ago here in Louisville in response to the police shooting of Breonna Taylor. We're still awaiting the results of an investigation by the Attorney General and federal officials and a decision, possible decision, on whether criminal charges will be filed against the officers involved in that shooting. But, Jake, you did some reporting this week about how Louisville Metro Police should have by now put together an analysis of how they responded to the first days of the protest in late May, what's called an after-action report, and they haven't done that yet as of this week. Tell us about what goes into those reports and why they haven't completed them.
So why they haven't completed it, Rick, is still unclear. We asked the department for something called an incident action plan, which is required also, which kind of just lays out the department's strategies and tactics for that weekend. We asked the department for that on June 1st, which was kind of the day after the first weekend of protests that many people will remember when there was widespread vandalism and violence in downtown Louisville. There were 7 people shot on Thursday night, May 28th, and then there was Mr. David McAtee was shot and killed by the National Guard a few days after that. So it was an extraordinary weekend in downtown. And so we, you know, according to LMPD standard operating procedures, for things like civil disturbances like that, they are required to create an incident action plan. And then once that disturbance has been brought under control, they are required to complete an after-action report. And what goes into an after-action report is basically just a broad analysis of their strategies and their tactics to see what worked, what didn't work, and how they can improve it for future similar incidents. The department first just did not respond to the open records request, so we appealed that to the Attorney General's office. And after we asked the Attorney General to step in, the department responded that, you know, they didn't give us the incident action plan because they said that that would hamper their ability to stop a terrorism event. But also they said they don't have any after action report. So, you know, it indicates that they did not do the after action report. And I talked to some experts about that. And some, you know, everyone said it was problematic that you need to analyze how you respond to events. That first weekend kind of set the tone for the weeks of protests that have followed. And Attica Scott, state representative, said that, you know, the agency should be analyzing their response every single day that they're out there. You know, police officers are tear gassing people. They were tear gassing people and, you know, firing other non-lethal munitions at people and addressing protesters in riot gear. So it would just provide insight into at least how the department thinks their response went.
And so the police department, and this is an LMPD policy that these reports have to be filled out, completed.
That's right, yeah.
So they haven't given you a reason why they haven't filled them out. Some have said, you know, well, there's been a lot going on, and there's been a lot of overtime work by officers, and there's been an organizational disruption with the firing of the police chief after the David McAtee shooting. But they haven't given you any concrete reason why these reports from late May, early June haven't been released or haven't been completed?
No, I asked the department for an interview. I sent them a list of questions, and I never heard back from our police department. And, you know, I've talked to policing experts who brought that point up, that, listen, there's a lot going on right now. There's protests. There's a pandemic. There's staffing issues associated with the pandemic. But, you know, these protests, though they've been ongoing, there have been quiet moments, right? There have been lulls in the protests that have allowed someone in the department to have some time to create the report. And reports, as a lot of people may or may not know, reports are, you know, a basic element of policing. There is paperwork done for nearly everything a police officer does. So this is just routine police work. Why it hasn't been done, we still don't know. We'd like to know, because we'd like to know if the department thought their response that first weekend was appropriate, what they decided to change, and why.
And you talked to the president of the Metro Council, David James, about this, because the council has its own investigation underway on how, as to the reaction to the and the handling of the shootings of Breonna Taylor and David McAtee, as well as the protest.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So Councilman David James, he's the council president. He's a former police officer. He was a narcotics detective, and he was the president of the police union. Okay, and he said these after-action reports are pretty routine. He was shocked that this report hasn't been done for that first weekend. And he said that as the council goes back to investigate what has taken place with these protests over the past several weeks, that those documents, an after-action report, would be a critical piece of record for the council to review to see what the police department says happened. And since they don't have that, that's a big problem. And as the days continue to pass, memories begin to fade from that night. And those nights that happened that first weekend, it makes it all the more problematic why we don't already have a report to see how the agency responded, to see how they think their strategies worked or what they would have changed in the aftermath of the chaos, really, that unfolded downtown. You know, I mean, people remember the vandalism that happened. You know, you go up and down 4th Street and windows are broken. There was mass arrests. There was injuries and there was death.
Just very quickly, and you may not know this, but you know what the status is of the search for a new chief of police since the firing of Steve Conrad?
No, that's a good question. I haven't heard any update. You know, right now we have interim police chief Robert Schroeder, so I don't know. That's a good question.
There is a search underway that has been launched, a formal search. All right, Jake Ryan.
I imagine so.
Jake, thank you very much. Let's turn to Ryan Van Velzer, WFPL. Ryan, you've been reporting this week on coronavirus testing, specifically a shortage of testing supplies and long turnaround times on test results, both here in our region and across the country. And on the supply side, here in Louisville, one of the major healthcare companies, Norton Healthcare, reached out to some members of the state's congressional delegation for help in getting certain supplies. And as you report, all this is hampering the ability of health officials to track and try to contain the spread of COVID-19. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So last week, Norton Chief Medical Officer Stephen Hester, he wrote to U.S. Representative John Yarmuth and Senator Mitch McConnell, and he's asking for help. Essentially, one of the vendors that provides testing supplies to Norton said that they couldn't provide those supplies because the federal government had intervened and needed those supplies themselves. The supplies are reagents, and these reagent is basically a chemical necessary to conduct the test. And without the necessary reagents, Norton can't do all the tests that it needs to do to function. And to put that in perspective, Norton has done about 10% of all the nasal swab testing in the state.
So delays in getting test results, as you reported, affect this other piece of the solution, the planned solution, contact tracing, right?
Yeah. So the longer it takes for a test to come back, the more potential contacts a person may have in that interim. And basically, you know, Dr. Sarah Moyer with Louisville Public Health has said that once you get 7 to 10 days out, if it takes 7 to 10 days for a test to come back, that basically makes contact tracing unfeasible at that point because of the number of contacts that person might have in that time period. So we really need to have widespread testing if we really want to do the contact tracing, which is necessary to both understand where the virus is at in our communities and to box it in and prevent it from spreading further.
What do officials say is a reasonable turnaround time for getting results? I took one last week. I got mine almost exactly 3 days afterward.
Yeah, two to three days, you know, obviously 24 hours would be the best, but 2 days is about average. And I will say that Gravity Diagnostics, which is the state's main lab for testing, has been able to maintain those turnaround times of about 48 hours. It's the national labs that are seeing the largest problems, like Quest Diagnostics. Their average turnaround time for everyone but the highest priority patients remains 7 to 10 days.
And you also reported that Kroger, which was an early player in all this and in providing testing locations, plans to stop drive-through testing statewide.
Yeah, that's right. By the end of the week, I believe that they will be ending testing statewide. Governor Beshear has said he is working to try and find somebody to fill that gap. I do just want to take a minute to look at the 7-day averages of cases over the last few weeks. You know, we saw some really high spikes in cases basically over the last 3 weeks. That the spike really happened in the second week and third week of July. Over the last few days, Governor Beshear has said that the mask mandate, which went into effect in early July, is now beginning to see the impacts of that. He believes the virus has started to level off, and we are seeing that reflected in case counts so far. And he believes we might be reaching a new plateau with cases, although they remain still much higher than they were a month ago.
Yeah, as of this week, in the 600 range, right?
I'm looking at the case counts by week, and the last week's case counts by the 7-day average was about 3,900 cases last week. And right now we're at 1,600 cases, and we still got a couple of days to go here.
Yeah, I was talking about daily cases around 600 or so, but much higher than we had before, but it appears to be leveling off. And it will be some time before we will see any effect from the closing of bars for 2 weeks and the cutting back of restaurant capacity, right?
Oh, right. Yes. And my mistake, you know, I was saying 7-day averages. It was actually mm-hmm. 7-day totals.
Right.
But, you know, Beshear, when he put that bar, you know, he put that the ban on bars in place, that was for 2 weeks. Obviously, they're going to reassess depending on where the numbers are at.
All right, Ryan Van Velzer and Jake Ryan, the two Ryans, thank you so much for joining us on In Conversation. And time for a break.
Thanks, Rick.
When we come back, we will talk about the Fancy Farm Picnic, past, present, and future, and later we'll preview the fall political campaigns and how they'll be affected by the coronavirus pandemic, racial justice demonstrations, and more. This is In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
The 134th annual Fancy Farm Picnic. It is great to be back in West Kentucky. And what a huge crowd for Senator McConnell's retirement party.
For all of you out-of-towners, this is the place where Republicans tell it like it is. Jack Conway curses. Governor Beshear drones on about Obamacare. And Alison Lundgren Grimes unveils her foreign policy.
Some sounds from the Fancy Farm picnic. That was, of course, Republican Senator Mitch McConnell, and at the time his Democratic challenger, Alison Lundgren Grimes, former Kentucky Secretary of State as well, speaking at the 2014 Fancy Farm picnic. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, the 140th Fancy Farm picnic is tomorrow on the grounds of St. Jerome Catholic Church in the Graves County community. In a typical year, thousands of people come to the grounds to enjoy West Kentucky barbecue, games, and other church picnic activities, capped by the great American tradition of political speeches, including some zingers and heckling. But this, of course, is not a typical year, and tomorrow's picnic will be much different, scaled back with no political speeches this time because of the coronavirus precautions. But that's not going to stop us from talking about this year's event and the picnic's great history. And joining us to do that are Andy Hayden, one of the many organizers of the Fancy Farm Picnic, and Cynthia Elder, who not only lives in Fancy Farm, but several years ago published a book about St. Jerome Church, where the picnic is held. It's called The Catholic Settlement, A History of St. Jerome Catholic Church, 1836 to 2011. Andy, Cynthia, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Andy, let's start with you. Let's talk about this year's picnic. We tend to focus on the political speeches here, but this is, of course, a major fundraiser for St. Jerome. How important is it to keeping the parish afloat financially each year?
I mean, it is a huge fundraiser for the church. A lot of the money that we raise does go into operating expenses that the church incurs. But probably more importantly, the money that's raised also is used to do a lot of philanthropy work, help a lot of charities out locally. And so that's going to be one of the major things that we see, obviously, with the lack of sales, I guess, with a normal picnic would be.
So tell us a little bit of how things are going to be different this year at Fancy Farm.
Yeah, so typically on in years past on Friday night, we normally have a 1 mile classic that is geared toward the children, for them to run a 1 mile race. The kids obviously love that; they're able to get out a little bit. Right after that, we have a 5K that usually goes on Friday night as well, and then on Saturday. The meat by the pound goes on sale at 8 a.m. And, the event kicks off at 10 a.m. and goes until 10 p.m. So
are you scaling back? There are, of course, no political speeches. There was a thought for a while, I think, of moving those indoors, but that has been scrapped. But will there be the traditional games and the sort of things that you normally find at the picnic?
No, we will. This year we are, like I said, we're going to do the meat by the pound will go off at 8 a.m. and we will be selling raffle tickets for a Polaris Ranger that we have that we'll be raffling off at 6 p.m. But there will not be the traditional bingo and the kid games, and we usually have a huge cafeteria where we sell where you buy a meal ticket and the home cooked meal and the veggies and things of that nature, and fried chicken, pork and mutton, all of those things have been canceled. So mainly our, it's just going to be the meat by the pound purchased, and, be able to get your raffle ticket, and the drawing will take place at 6 p.m.
Now, you normally sell, about 20,000 pounds of meat during the picnic every year?
Yes, it's right at 19,000 is typically what we do. This year, we have scaled that back. We're going to do 11,000 pounds is what it's on the pit as we speak. So,
and obviously there's going to be a huge drop in people turning up, because a lot of people come from around the state and the region to hear the speeches, right?
Absolutely. Typically on a Saturday, somewhere mid morning to lunchtime, you'll start seeing, the people that are coming for the political speaking usually starts at 2 p.m. So you start to see those folks rolling in, you know, late mornings or, like I said, around noon. They usually partake in the, you know, in our lunch, and, you know, they're on the grounds. And it's obviously a huge presence for when those folks arrive for the political speaking. So things are certainly going to look different.
Has in your memory or anyone's memory, have the speeches ever been canceled in recent years for any reason?
Not that I'm aware of. Cynthia may be more equipped to answer that question. But I honestly, not in my lifetime anyway. So.
I can't recall them either. Well, let's turn to Cynthia Elder, who wrote the aforementioned book that I talked about St. Jerome Parish, St. Jerome Church. She actually edited the book, compiled the information in it, where the picnic is held in Graves County, Kentucky. Before there was a church picnic, there was, of course, a church, and Cynthia, St. Jerome has a rich history of its own, the picnic notwithstanding, right?
Oh, definitely. It's this is the 140th anniversary of the picnic, but the church has been around a lot longer than that. And the way the picnic started was they just wanted to have a homecoming, a family get together. You know, it was a time of year that the farmers weren't really busy. You know, the crops were in the ground, and they could take some time off. And so that's the way it began, and that's the way it was for quite a few years. But then back in 1880, they put an ad in the paper and invited surrounding communities to come to the picnic, and that's how it all started.
So, at what point did the political speeches come into play?
Well, you know, if you've got a crowd, the politicians are going to show up.
Oh yeah,
right. So probably from the very beginning, people that were running for office came around because there was a crowd. And so when politicians would come, then more people would come. And so as a community, the church pretty much embraced that, because the more people that came, the more meat they could sell, the more dinners they could serve, the more lemonade they could sell. And so they made more money doing that. But it really got big in the last, I would say, 100 years or so. Alvin Barkley, who was Harry Truman's vice president, is from this area. Actually, he was born about a mile up the road from my house. And so he would, and Happy Chandler, you know, they were big political adversaries. And so they would run the circuit. A lot of times they would drive together to different events. And you know, beat each other up on the stage, but get in the car together. And so that's when it got to be pretty big. And they were both huge advocates for the picnic out in Fancy Farm. They just thought it was the greatest thing. And honestly, Happy Chandler would not leave the picnic grounds, contrary to what happens today. But he would not leave the picnic grounds until every person was gone. He would, you know, the band would play till late at night after the speeches were over, and he danced with anybody who would dance with him. And of course, it's in August, and so he wore that three-piece white suit, and it would just be drenched by the time he left the picnic grounds. Yeah.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL. We're talking to Cynthia Elder, who is a resident of Fancy Farm and wrote a book a number of years ago about St. Jerome Church, where the picnic is held. It's called The Catholic Settlement, A History of St. Jerome Catholic Church, 1836 to 2011. And Andy Hayden is on the phone with us as well. He's one of the organizers of the Fancy Farm picnic, which is being scaled back dramatically, unfortunately, this year because of the coronavirus. Well, let me pose that question I asked to Andy to you, Cynthia. Do you recall any time or in your research or throughout history, world wars or otherwise, of the political speeches not being held at Fancy Farm?
No, there's always been politicians there, and the community has always allowed those politicians to talk. And you know, it was pretty much, it wasn't organized back, years ago when, say, during the World Wars, when the picnic was scaled back. You know, we always give away a vehicle every year, but during the World Wars, we raffled off a washing machine or something like that rather than a vehicle. And so I'm sure back during the wars that the picnic was scaled back, not to the extent that we're doing it right now. But also the politicians were not a part of the schedule. Like I said, they would just show up and they'd draw a crowd and they'd start talking to that crowd. And it was back in Happy Chandler and Alvin Barkley's time that the community actually gave them a venue to be a part of. And it was out in front of the old school, actually on the steps of the old school. And they would get up there and there was no microphones or, you know, they just would start talking. And there was quite a few trees in that yard. And so there was plenty of shade and people would just sit and make their opinions known, as they still do today. There's a ton of heckling. And, you know, nothing is more exciting than to see this little old man who never says a word, you know, throughout the year, get up there and call those politicians on everything they're saying.
Well, it's
that's mm-hmm. the way it worked back then.
Well, the speeches have obviously grown. Now there's a pavilion. You have KETs out there. They broadcast it live. And, of course, it gets major media coverage.
Right. Oh, yeah. We get coverage from around the world, and we get people coming from around the world. The last, when Allison Grimes, who we know by on first name basis down here, we know all these people on first name basis. So when Allison ran against Senator McConnell, she, you know, it was a huge, when she announced, the year she announced, it was a huge picnic, and we were not expecting a huge picnic. And there were reporters here from Japan. And they were following that story. And we were like, really? There were people that sat behind the meat stand, reporters that we have picnic tables back where we sell barbecue by the pound. And they were sitting there sending off their stories because they had been up listening to the speeches. They got the information they needed and came down, needed a place to write. And they found our picnic tables and sat there and wrote.
It's a tradition that has really stayed with you. It's kind of faded throughout the rest of the country. You know, the great tradition of politicians on a hot day standing on a stump and giving their speeches, trying to get people to vote for them.
Oh yeah, and you know that's probably, we get people that want to have this same kind of event in their community, and we just sort of laugh because we couldn't tell you how to do this. We couldn't tell you how to organize this. It just happens. I mean, everybody has their job. Everybody knows their job. And it just comes together every year. Now, that's not to say that our picnic committee doesn't work themselves to death, as Andy will attest to. You know, you don't have to tell people what to do on picnic day because they've been doing it all their lives.
Now, you live in Fancy Farm, but you are not from Fancy Farm, right?
No, I'm from Louisville.
How did you end up settling in Fancy Farm?
That is such a long story. basically, I went to Red Cross camp with a girl from Fancy Farm, and we became pen pals. And we were pen pals all the way through high school and college. And when we married the same year. And when I divorced, I had two little kids, and I was like, I just need to leave town. And she's like, well, come on down here. And I'm like, are you crazy? So I came to Western Kentucky, found a good job, and lived down here. And I think it was 4 years later that I started dating her brother and married him. So I met him for the first time when I was 19. And 19 years later, we were married. And we've been married almost 25 years.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Well, My late mother, Lucy Hallett, was born in Fancy Farm in 1921, and she used to love to go back occasionally. I've never been to the picnic, but I've been back through there with her, and it's a great place. Let me come back to you, Andy. Give us a sense of how many, in a typical year, not this year, how many people work on the picnic and what kind of army you have trying to get all that stuff done.
That's a good question. That's one that's been asked before, and I don't really know, honestly. We have so many people that come in that maybe were from Fancy Farm, they grew up here, went to church here, maybe they moved off, but they always have that homecoming that Cynthia spoke about. They still come home for it, and they find themselves in a booth somewhere or in a meat stand or in a bingo, selling bingo chances or whatever. Honestly, I couldn't even begin to give you a number, but I would say it's in the upwards of 300 to 400 of us at a minimum, probably. But every family, as Cynthia talked about, every family kind of has their thing. As organizers, we don't have any concerns about telling, this family, hey, go do this, because they've been doing it for longer than I've been alive, and they can tell me how to do it. So, it's without those extended families or those families that moved off and that come back, I'm not sure we could pull it off to the scale that it is, that we normally have. So it's always amazing to me. Even people that live here, maybe in surrounding counties, that are friends of a family, you look up and they're inside a booth. They don't go to church at St. Jerome. They don't, live in Fancy Farm, but you look up and there they are working in a booth. So it really is not just a St. Jerome, parishioners that are working. It's those extended family members and then friends from surrounding areas as well. So,
are you a native of Fancy Farm?
I am. Yes, I live just across the county line in Carlisle County, but yes, I've gone to St. Jerome since I was born. So.
And before we run out of time, can you recap again the hours of the picnic and the various activities?
Yeah. So tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., the pork and mutton will go on sale by the pound. Basically, what we're going to do is we're going to sell that until we run out. It's on a first come, first serve basis. And so that will be, hopefully by noon or so. Then at 6 p.m., we will be raffling or doing our drawing for the raffle that we've done for a Polaris Ranger. And that'll be live streamed on our St. Jerome Fancy Farm Picnic Facebook page for those that may have purchased a ticket online. And let me back up at 11 a.m., a very important thing that goes on that kind of gets overshadowed because of the political speaking. They have what's called the Graves County Pioneer Award. That award is presented to a person or a couple.
Andy, I'm going to have to cut you off there, but we will link to that on our website. Andy Hayden and Cynthia Elder, thank you both for joining us. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
My name is Gatewood Galbraith, and I'm an independent candidate for governor. We don't want a political party. My running mate and I, hey, dear, if you're going to use your outside voice, go over and join the other children over on the playground. We're trying to get some serious conversation going on here, okay? So you go over with the other kids over there. People say, Galbraith, you're a perennial candidate. And I said, well, Kentucky's got perennial problems. If the people had beaten me the first time and solved the problems, I wouldn't have had to run again. But they didn't, and they haven't, and they can't. Because neither party can produce a candidate that can disengage from the partisanship long enough to work with the other side to actually get the job done.
us, the late Gatewood Galbraith, speaking at the 2011 Fancy Farm Picnic. I believe he was running for governor that year, one of the five times he ran for governor. Yeah, he mentioned a running mate. He also ran unsuccessfully for agriculture commissioner and attorney general. He passed away, sadly, in 2012, one of the great characters in Kentucky politics. And welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. Gatewood Galbraith is a tough act to follow, but Al Cross and I will take a shot at it. Al is a professor in the University of Kentucky School of Journalism and Media and director of its Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues. And we should point out his opinions are his own and not necessarily UK's. He's also a long-serving political writer for the Courier Journal, and you can also see him on KET, where he is a political commentator. Al, welcome to the program.
Glad to be with you, and I used to be political writer for the Courier Journal. Now I write an occasional column about Kentucky politics for that newspaper and others, and it's housed actually at kyforward.com and the Northern Kentucky Tribune.
Yeah, you were at the Courier. You actually left the Courier in 2004, right? And then
that's right,
occasional contributor. All right. Well, let's start with Fancy Farm. Then we'll get into the fall campaigns. No political speeches this year, and that's of course a big draw for the picnic itself. But what, if any, impact does that have? The absence of those speeches have on the various candidates for office this fall?
Well, Fancy Farm is always an inflection point in any race. For all the campaigns, it's an opportunity to get some extra traction and a possible pitfall. Not many campaigns are won at Fancy Farm, but some have been lost. And it's more a matter of avoiding error. You are expected to show up, and they don't forgive you in Western Kentucky if you don't. The absence of Fancy Farm this year means that the U.S. Senate race is likely to continue in the on the course that it has been on for some time since the primary on June 23rd. We'll have a lot of television spending by both candidates. We will have limited personal appearances. Senator McConnell tends to use the Senate recesses to go around and talk about what sort of help he's given to local communities, particularly hospitals in the latest relief act. And Amy McGrath had been more reluctant to get out. That was a pitfall for her in the primary. She didn't attend the protest, and Charles Booker made an ad out of that. And McGrath really seemed reluctant, I think because of family reasons, to get out and do much personal campaigning. She initially, of course, didn't see the need to do that because she was such a favorite. Then when Booker mounted a real challenge, she began some limited appearances. Now she has hit upon a new tack. She's going to make fly-in appearances at airports, presumably, in places around the state. The first one was at Harlan, and it wasn't at the airport because in Harlan, the airport's up on top of the mountain. You got to take 15 minutes to get into town. But they announced this last week as a tactic to get out and campaign in the pandemic. And presumably at airports, you can be easily socially distanced. You know, you're not supposed to have gatherings of more than 10 people, at least under the governor's current order. There's not much enforcement of that, but, you know, any political candidate is going to want to avoid news stories about running counter to government policy. So it'll be interesting to see how she pulls this off. McConnell's appearances have been limited to invited media and local officials. And he has never been a great one for big rallies anyway. If there's a party event, he would be there. If the president comes to town, he'd be there. But I don't think we're going to see those kinds of events in this race this fall.
Yeah, it's hard to replace shaking hands and kissing babies, but coronavirus has all but put a stop to that. She kind of stumbled coming out of the gate, Amy McGrath, I'm talking about, in the primary. What does she really need to do to convince voters that Senator McConnell has been in there long enough? And what sort of strategy do you see him employing, if any at all? Does he just stay the course of what he's doing now?
Well, more and more in this country, Senate races are coattailed by presidential races. If you're on the same ballot with the president, the presidential vote is likely to be determinative of the Senate vote. We saw that in 2016 when Trump surprisingly won and Republicans surprisingly retained their majority. Those two things went hand in hand. In this case, Trump is in trouble in most other states, and Senator McConnell may very well lose his majority. But in this state, Trump remains pretty popular. His approval rating remains in the mid to high 50s, from what I've seen. And that is higher than Senator McConnell. So the senator has to not get separated from Trump, but I think he does see some growing restiveness within his own party about Trump. And you could see that in the Republican primary vote. There were a number of counties that tended to be the higher income, better educated counties, where a number of Republicans, sometimes as much as 20%, voted for somebody other than Mitch McConnell and voted for uncommitted rather than Trump for president. So there has been a slight erosion of that Republican base. But on the other hand, Trump and McConnell have drawn into their orbit a lot of people who used to identify as Democrats. Now, Democrats have been moving in the Republican direction in this state for a long time, and that was accelerated in the Obama administration. Obama was really bad for the Democratic brand in the state, but Trump has, I think, made Trump Republicans out of a lot of Democrats. So McGrath's only opening, I think, is to appeal to those people who voted for Donald Trump because he was a room breaker, an upsetter, candidate who ran against the elites. I did a book chapter about this for a book on Trump journalism and democracy, and I concluded that the principal fundamental reason that elected Trump was a resentment of elites, largely by people in rural America. Trump got 62% of the rural vote. That was more than any candidate for president had ever gotten. And there's a sense in a lot of rural America that it's being left behind. It's being disrespected by the urban elites. And they liked Donald Trump. In Kentucky, there are a certain class of people who see McConnell as being part of the elite that should be rebuked, taken down a notch in the vernacular. And what McGrath has to do is get those anti-elite McConnell and Trump voters to go her way when it comes to voting in the Senate race. It is going to be difficult, but she has a campaign war chest that is just about equal that of McConnell's at last report. And McConnell has never really had to put up with that kind of opposition. He's always had the financial advantage. Now, I think in the end, he will have the financial advantage because there will be a number of outside groups come in here to help him out. Everybody wants to curry favor with the Republican leader and the potential majority leader, of course. There'll be some outside groups come in from McGrath, too, but I doubt they'll be as heavily spending as those on the Republican side. So McConnell will have a financial advantage, but, when you pile up $50 or $60 million, you reach a point of diminishing returns. So I think they will effectively be equal on television. It's been interesting to watch the recent TV. He has been out advertising her on TV. And he's also stepped up the attacks. You know, he's now got people on there accusing McGrath of supporting Nancy Pelosi's left-wing agenda. Not a great deal of support for that, but there wasn't a great deal of support for the assertions that McGrath is making in her ads about McConnell caring only about big business and the passage of the Relief Act. The truth is not going to do very well in this race, it looks like.
And the events with the demonstrations, especially here in Louisville, but around the country, they have forced both of them to address race in their campaign advertising, right?
I haven't really noticed that much from McConnell. He has addressed it in other sorts of venues. Has always had a pretty good record on civil rights, and that has never been one of his pitfalls. His critics would say he's not doing anything to restore portions of the Voting Rights Act and so on, but I don't see him engaging too much on that among his Republican supporters who care about those things. Essentially, moderate to liberal Republicans in Louisville, largely, they know where McConnell is on that, and they really have no misgivings about it, I think.
Yeah, I think the only spot I've seen addressing that is one that talked mostly about the tearing down of statues.
Oh, well, yes, he did try to capitalize on the overzealousness of some of these protesters in, tearing down statues of General Grant, for example. General Grant once owned slaves, but he set them free before the Civil War. That is a danger, I think, for Democrats nationwide. They will be identified with these overzealous protests, and Trump is clearly trying to do that. I think Trump's basically running a scare campaign at this point. I doubt that that is going to work. But in Kentucky, I think there's still a great deal of patriotic feeling and resentment against these kinds of protests, and McConnell knows the state very well, probably picked that up in his polling, and for a couple of weeks he did run ads trying to capitalize on that.
Well, during the primary, most Kentuckians voted by mail because of coronavirus. Secretary of State Michael Adams, a Republican, wants to go back to most folks voting in person on Election Day, but allowing vulnerable citizens to vote by mail. Of course, he has to come to an agreement with Governor Beshear, who's a Democrat, on that. What do you see happening ultimately?
Well, the reasonable compromise would be some narrower kind of excuse for absentee voting. Absentee excuses are never checked on. They could narrow this without having a great deal of effect. They could say, anybody over 50 or 60 years old is qualified for a medical excuse absentee ballot. And there are other things they could do. I think Republicans have taken as an article of faith that they don't like a lot of absentee voting, and they certainly don't like generalized mail-in balloting like a few states do. And they sort of had a knee-jerk reaction to this. To Adams's credit, he is not having a knee-jerk reaction. I think he is feeling the pressure, surely, from his fellow Republicans to not be as lenient as they were in the primary. So I expect there will be some kind of compromise, but it is unlikely to be substantially different from the primary because the pandemic is not likely to be much better than it was at that point. And there's plenty of good arguments for keeping it pretty much as it was. Adams has tried to recruit more poll workers And I said the night of the primary and around it, I said the problem with traditional election procedure is most poll workers are over 60, and they don't want to spend 12 hours indoors with a lot of people who might have the virus. It just doesn't make sense for them to do that kind of thing. So I think it was smart for Adams to try to recruit more poll workers. I suggested they make a special effort to recruit younger people who seem to be energized by the primary. You know, that would pay long-term dividends. You know, people who are poll workers tend to do it for a long time. I don't know how that is going. I doubt they're going to be all that effective in getting very many. But they also have time, unlike they did in the primary, to try to find new polling locations that where you might be able to social distance in an easier way. And I wish them good luck at that, because we're going to have a big turnout this fall, and every voter needs to be accommodated. We don't need to be discouraging people from voting in any way.
Just got about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about Allison Lundigan Grimes. We heard a cut from her earlier at Fancy Farm. She's not on the ballot this time, but her father, Jerry Lundigan, former Democratic Party chairman in Kentucky, big player in the Democratic Party, is going to prison for campaign finance violations related to her Senate run back in.
Unless he gets, they decide to stay the sentence pending appeal.
It's still going up. She was never charged, but how do you think this will affect her political future?
Well, it's unlikely to do it any good. She seems to be concentrating on a family at this point, and you know, you can certainly do that and politics too. But it seems a pretty good time to take a respite and sort of let people forget who Jerry Lundigan is.
All right, Al Cross, always a pleasure having you on, and thanks for joining us today, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Glad to be with you.
Al Cross, professor in the University of Kentucky School of Journalism and Media and director of its Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues. Of course, he is a political writer and political commentator as well. Thanks to Al for joining us. And that's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks to our In Conversation production team, Michelle Tyrene Johnson, Laura Ellis, Brad Yost, Russell Wells, Bill Burton on news, and our theme was composed by Kojin Toshiro. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.